Hello and welcome to a special pre-recorded edition of Radio Edutalk. What follows is a discussion that took place earlier in 2013 at an event organised by the Scottish Residential Childcare Workers Association. They host regular events called A Tea and a Talk, and this particular event, of which you're about to hear a 1 hour excerpt, practitioners, professionals in the area of residential childcare had a discussion about restraint, good practice, bad practice, or practice of note. And the discussion starts off following a kind of question about myself about what we mean by seclusion and requiring young people for whatever reason to experience a period of seclusion in a residential setting. We then go on to talk about many issues around what's known as physical interventions. And you'll hear from, as I say, various professionals and practitioners. I'll just refer to them by their first name. We've got Phil, Kathleen, Brody, Laura, and myself, David Noble. You may find some of the discussion very new to you. You might find some of it quite uncomfortable. And please don't hesitate to get in touch with myself or with the Scottish Residential Childcare Workers Association should you require more context about the topic of the show, and if you're looking for more information or indeed training relating to physical intervention and everything associated with these particular practices. You can leave a comment, a brief comment of course, on Twitter. Just include the hashtag Edutalk, EDUTALK, and feel free to email the show at any point. The email address is edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. I hope you enjoy the discussion that follows.
I think, firstly, the important thing I think to acknowledge is seclusion is a very controversial practice across lots and lots of settings, and has been actually for a very long time, so the controversy isn't terribly new. Neither seclusion and restraint, I think, could reasonably describe as evidence-based practice, because the evidence supported, perhaps, but not, I think, evidence-based. There's a further issue, though, in relation particularly to education in Scotland, that there's no definition in statute or guidance of what seclusion is. The only kind of guidance, statutory definition in Scottish social policy anywhere is a definition which is in a Mental Welfare Commission report. And actually, it's not a terribly good definition. It's a very narrow definition, and it replaces a kind of earlier definition. And the current definition says you're only secluded, which means you are placed in a locked fast room on your own, isolated from others, and your egress is prevented if that room is designated a seclusion room. So
if you're secluded in a room that isn't designated for seclusion and you're locked in or not allowed to leave, it's not.
Well, according to that Mental Welfare Commission, it's not seclusion, and I think that's a very unhelpful definition, both because it kind of doesn't tie in with the kind of question of unlawful imprisonment. Now, that might sound odd, but you can clearly be unlawfully imprisoned without being put in a seclusion room. And if you're arguing that this process is therapeutic or part of an attempt to manage a person's behaviour therapeutically, I think framing it in that way is a really narrow and restrictive sense of it. The example we were talking about earlier on was a primary age child with autistic spectrum, global learning difficulties, behaviour become very distraught. Staff believe that they simply reduce the stimuli by removing the other kids from the room, then hold the door shut with looking through a kind of one-way mirror that the child can't see, so they're monitoring the child's welfare. Technically, that meets seclusion according to several other definitions, including an English definition of seclusion in education. But there's no definition in education. And I think it can, in some instances, such as that example, meet the kind of the criteria of least restrictive intervention. So a child who wouldn't calm with being restrained, who might become very distraught, who might find restraint traumatic, whereas lowering or getting everybody out there and meeting and allowing them to throw a chair or two about, I think actually arguably could be argued to be in the child's best interests.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a kind of vacuum in terms of guidance which isn't helpful. But there's also potentially, I think, issues around, we were talking about kind of safe spaces, and safe spaces are just a proprietary product, they're not good or bad. But I think there's some things that having a kind of ball pit in your classroom with a net that can be fastened with a big zip that only opens the outside, and putting a child in it for a couple of hours, I think also represents a form of seclusion. So there's an interesting semantic debate. You know, leave aside the philosophical issues about whether you would support it or not, or if you support it, how you prevent it from being abused. Because
mm-hmm.
there's certainly strong evidence in Pindown Inquiry, a number of inquiries, that restraint was abused, but seclusion was particularly abused, because if a child's behaviour was particularly distressing and causing staff huge difficulty in terms of management, if you put the child out of sight, out of mind in seclusion, then there's a paper by Tom Mason, one of the first serious studies in relation to seclusion, which is quite old now, and Tom talked about seclusion as a staff stress management device. that's what it was, and I don't think he was historically wrong. But I think the debate we were having prior to starting recording is that perhaps there are a tiny proportion of children for whom seclusion might be appropriate if it's contextualised, if it's within an appropriate policy framework, if the appropriate safeguarding measures are in place.
Yeah. I think it's kind of across the sector, I would say it's possibly creeping back in and being framed as isolation. So you maybe put a kid in isolation for a couple of hours or on a one-to-one with staff, and there's that way people stop to recognise that it's seclusion, and so it's almost in your head falling under a different bracket, because it's one-on-one, or it's in the room with a staff member outside the door.
Certainly the definition internationally seems to be this: the child is in the room on its own with a staff member outside the door.
Yeah.
And the notion actually isn't whether the door is locked or not, it's whether the child's egress is prevented. You know, and that might be by, you know, an unwritten understanding. If the child comes out of the room, they will be restrained. You know, you don't need to lock the door in order to...
Or even hold it.
Yes, exactly, in terms of room.
It's used, and people I know from the security services say they use it in that way, with the door locked. So because the door's locked, it's not so much that the child will be restrained if they leave, but it tends to happen more the other way around. The person is invited to go to the room, but the understanding is that if they don't, they will be helped to do so.
Well, and also seclusion in your own bedroom is an interesting consideration as well, which probably happens quite a lot in secure settings and isn't called seclusion.
As well, local authorities.
Yeah. Put locking kids in their own bedrooms. Wow, okay. Yeah. We had a seclusion room in the last place I worked in Colorado, and that was highly legislated and lots of form filling out, and we didn't use it very often and we didn't like it. And one of the things we were talking about earlier was that was even more of a last resort than restraint, because in restraint at least we were sticking with that kid through it and tried to stay in relationship through it and still convey that we cared about them and that we were trying to keep them safe. And it was only when we felt that a young person just couldn't calm down with that physical contact, or there were two different young people where the sense was one, and I think about her quite often, and she would say, "You're going to have to restrain me today. There's nothing you can do." And there was a sense that she was even getting sexual gratification from it. And so it was probably a not very well thought out attempt to not reinforce that pattern and not do that, and yet it was almost physically impossible to deposit her into the room and then leave the room and shut and lock the door anyway. So it just, on a practical level, again, notwithstanding, you know, the therapeutic or philosophical beliefs that one might have, it just didn't work very well at all. And so, but we didn't use it very often, and we took it very seriously and had a kind of stomach ache about it, although we did about restraint as well. But anyway, yeah.
think it's always an interesting technical issue if you do think seclusion is appropriate as a issue. How do you get the child to seclusion? Because if you're you're only using it for a child who is an immediate severe risk.
Yes.
If they're complying, then they're not being secluded because they're agreeing to go there voluntarily.
Yes.
And if you
so you shouldn't be doing it anyway.
It's safe to leave them on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of really interesting debates in relation to, and having tried to move people to moving people under restraint is notoriously difficult.
Yes.
It's a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Unless you have a really significant height, weight, strength advantage, even although you can technically compensate for those. It's just a difficult thing to do.
Yes.
And not only have you got to get them in, you've got to figure out how to get out.
Oh, that was the worst part.
Yes.
And it felt abandoning, it felt abusive, it felt horrible. So we didn't do it very often at all. But,
Certainly I feel as though I hear people talking about the use of seclusion almost as a way of reducing the number of restraints, and sometimes done actually up at a fairly low level, as a way of almost anticipating that something is escalating and trying to prevent it from escalating, generally by the young person agreeing to that, but with there being a bit of an undertone that it's, you know, the alternative to doing that by agreement is for that to be done in a compulsory way.
Mm-hmm.
I do find those some of these arguments quite difficult, though, because I feel as though the higher kind of level we set for a physical restraint or a seclusion taking place, the more likely we might be to end up in situations where we don't do those things, but maybe more people end up being locked up because their behaviour hasn't been managed in settings that didn't use any of those.
Do you mean like locked up in secure accommodation?
Yeah,
definitely. And in fact, the last tea in the talk, the woman who from foster care or from adoption was talking about that very thing in terms of not being able to hold on to kids metaphorically, but also with that literal component and you know, seeing kids go on to more restrictive environments.
Yeah.
Also, the police, the involvement of police, and hearing from students on the courses that I teach about, you know, even being instructed to call in the police for verbal abuse, you know, and part of it being driven by a desire to reduce restraints and involve police for things that, you know, used to be considered part of your job to try to deal with as kids were escalating. And so
there's a really old literature on restraint reduction which is worthwhile looking at, some of which is mental health, some of which is childcare, you know, because this is a route that has been gone down over several occasions of the years. And this debate about, you know, well, if we don't use restraint, we'll only take lower tariff people and they'll end up elsewhere. I don't think there's really evidence, if only because I don't think the evidence has been systematically collated.
Right.
Because I don't think kids are necessarily robustly assessed using kind of any kind of standardised instrument. You could really compare the kids in one service and kids from another. It's just not.
Yeah.
Our industry just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And the arguments that, you know, if you don't restrain, you might lose control and these kids will then, you know, be more dangerous, is an interesting one. I think you can think of examples where there are one or two notorious examples of kind of services where staff have kind of en masse refused to restrain everybody and they've lost control of the service and it's become unsafe, which I think is an angle that, you know, if you have staff who don't support your restraint reduction initiative, it would be quite easy for them to sabotage it by choosing not to restrain ever. You know, because staff groups can be very powerful in terms of their, you know, exercising that power. They have an awful lot should they choose to use it.
Yeah.
And there are one or two examples, I think, in the literature, certainly case studies of services. Lots of services misusing restraint, but one or two services who stopped using restraint and then the service just completely spiraled out of control.
Yeah. It's what it's being replaced with is the most important thing. It's not, and it's about, is what it's being replaced with meeting the needs of the child, or is it meeting the needs of the organization to reduce their numbers or look like they're doing something they should, or that sort of thing. And actually focusing on the child's need in the first place could probably reduce a lot of restraints, and focusing on what staff need in order to be able to do that, which was again the bulk of a lot of our conversation earlier about what staff need in order to be able to meet the needs of, you know, kids who have pretty complex, demanding kind of needs.
I think how you frame interventions is appropriate. I think actually there's a slight risk in framing interventions about restraint reduction without really engaging with staff beliefs and needs about restraint. I think framing interventions about creating safer services for everybody, which are about saying, well, reducing restraints, here's the data on staff being off sick following restraints. You know, actually, if we can reduce the number of restraints, then we can reduce the number of injuries to you, presents in a slightly different light to people that in actual fact that this project will have and has to have significant benefits for staff as well.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the danger is you don't take staff with you.
Yeah.
I know I used to wonder when I worked in 16 plus and it was a no-touch policy, how, you know, a kid could be in care one day and physically restrained, and then the next day, because we didn't use it, that they didn't present the same behaviours. But I think, you know, having been back within the field of using restraint for the last 4 or 5 years, the relationships were diluted when there was the no-touch, because there was just some parts of their lives where we didn't feel safe in case it did trigger those behaviours. So there was almost like that, you know, you got further and further apart. Whereas now I think it's not perfect, but I do think there's more of a willingness that wherever this kid wants to go today, I'm going with them. And kind of sticking with them. Because I know when it was the no-touch, we were just as afraid as the young people.
What may happen? That comes into, I suppose, a large field of your workload about the relation between the worker and the chair. So how does that kind of play with?
Well, I'm thinking containment, which won't be a surprise to anybody who's ever spoken to me about this subject at all. But it's about, and before I even knew about containment theory, I can remember talking to my staff about, if you can convey to kids that whatever you need to throw at me, I can catch it, and I can. And I can deal with it, and I'm going to stick with you, and I'm going to see you through it, and I can give it, you know, from a containment theory, I can give it back to you in a more manageable form. And if you can somehow get yourself to really believe that, even in the scary moments. And it was related to what you were saying earlier, Brody, about relational security. And I was thinking containment when you were talking about relational security, and containment is about, I can hold what you've got to throw at me and give it back to you, not with counter-aggression or revengeful stuff, but with genuine care for your well-being. And getting your staff team to feel like they can do that, which means they're being held properly, metaphorically. At 16, the 16 plus that you were talking about, what I was thinking about is what messages, even though they're not being spoken explicitly, about what you can and can't handle, and where you'll go with them and where you won't, which is less about restraint, but you can see the relationship of, I can absorb what you got to throw at me, even if that means I got to hold on to you, you know, even if that means you have to do something that's so dangerous that, you know. And as kids get 16, 17, 18 years old, the ability to actually convey that and live up to that becomes more challenging as their bodies get bigger and stronger as well. And so I was thinking about that when you were talking about it as well. Whereas when they're at a stage of their development where you really can deliver on that, and what happens when that gets breached, I worked with a kid here, and he was the one kid I didn't feel like we could do that for. And he scared me. He's the only kid that scared me in that way. I mean, I'd had scary moments with kids. And we didn't provide that containment or that holding for him very well at all. He scared everybody, I think, in the unit. So, and I had no idea how to help myself or the team make sense of that or deal with the fact that he scared us and that we didn't feel like we could hold him. Not even literally hold him, like the whole... the whole thing, the whole metaphoric psychological. He just scared us in so many different levels, and I don't think we did nearly as much for him as we wanted to. So, long answer, sorry. Yeah.
I think there are kids along who make us feel helpless.
Yeah.
And that's a really scary place to be, because our entire sense of worth is about being useful
and
helpful, yeah. And suddenly to be made to feel helpful.
Yeah.
And kind of how, where that feeling goes.
Where it comes from too, is it my own feeling of helplessness, yes. Or is it your complete feeling of helplessness that you bring to the situation? Mm. You've been separated from your family and how many placements and all of that. Mm. So it's that absorption, which again, I'm thinking containment, of course. Mm. I'm absorbing your sense of helplessness plus my own is being triggered. Mm. And then where do we go with that? And yet we hardly even talk about that. Or, you know, there were many conversations I had through my years of practice to talk about even having that feeling, let alone what you do with it. Yeah. And I definitely felt helpless a lot with certain kids, and those are the kids I remember most vividly, I think.
I think the strongest feeling I've had from all of my teams is you get to the point where everybody just feels stuck. Yeah. Nobody can see the way forward because we were all just kind of feeding off each other's anxiety.
Yeah.
What kind of impact?
How
does that play out in front of the children?
You get to a point where you back off and you don't engage. You're so stuck and you feel that you can't do anything in positive for them, and then it's that fear of actually. Maybe I'll do more harm than good. Because although we had the no touch, in the 16 plus, and it was non-restraint, but there was a lot of environmental restraint. So there was CCTV in all the corridors. It was a secure entry to the door. So if you didn't like their attitude at the door, they didn't get in. And then that included until 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And so for me, that's much more barbaric than the idea that when somebody gets to the extreme level of being at risk, that they need to be hold on to them. You know, I'm far more comfortable with that than actually a standoff at 6 in the morning for somebody who's freezing cold. That...
If that's your point of power, that's when you're going to use it, I guess.
Yeah. And how that stuckness gets reinforced too. Like, a kid is already feeling stuck, and that's part of why you all feel stuck. And then if you're reflecting that stuckness back because you don't know how to get unstuck with them, and the hopelessness that comes from that, and that's a really scary, when both the kid and the staff team are hopeless, that's a really bad place to be.
Brody, what are you involved in then in terms of training? Did I hear earlier on it's the CALM method, and you hear a lot of service providers talking about CALM versus PCI, etc. So I'm coming from a point of position of ignorance, so it'd be good to hear a bit more about CALM.
That's a very interesting question, which I will try to answer succinctly. Succinctness not being one of my strengths. Insight doesn't change my behaviour. CALM is an approach to violence prevention, and it would describe itself as being a kind of whole organisation approach, very much focused on kind of notions of primary, secondary and tertiary prevention. It's always operated from a cognitive behavioural perspective, which is strands in terms of mindfulness, and it increasingly operates from a trauma-informed perspective. Attachment's almost been part of it, but there's a kind of bit of trauma tied into that level of individual, team and organisation. The notion of kind of comparing systems, I think, is interesting, because in actual fact I think a lot of systems have strong similarities. Most services have now embraced the notion of whole organisation approach. Serious Case Review into Winterbourne said that all providers need to take this whole organisation review, and that I think will be a bit of a game changer, because there have been lots of violence prevention companies. There's 700 training on providers in the UK, which is terrifying. Lots of accreditation schemes which have merits and kind of disadvantages. Kevin McKenna, who's an Irish colleague of mine, suggested the fundamental problem actually has not been the training industry, strange enough. it's been a tendency within the sector to frame the management of violence as something that can be managed by a product. Whereas in actual fact, violence arises from a whole series of processes and interactions at a societal level, at an organisational level, at a cultural level. And unless you enable staff to, and at an individual level, unless you enable staff to engage with those, it's simply not going to work. So the fundamental issue is for any, I think, reasonable training provider, is how do you enable and support that process of reframing? Because ultimately what you're trying to deliver is transformation of the conditions that give rise to violence and aggression, and not simply better crisis management. That ties back into, you know, good practice going back some 200 years, and Chook's work reforming asylums in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. This is not new stuff, we just kind of lost sight of it. And it's as if we kind of lose sight of these insights, and then we rediscover them and go, wow, and think they're really new. And then you go back and read something written in the 17th century, thought, you know, actually, this is not new. And in actual fact, he expressed it more eloquently than we do. So there is, I think, that issue that we should, rather than think about products, we should think about processes. Training providers can be part of that, complement an internal process within the organisation. But I think the notion that training providers in and of themselves can change an organisation is wrong. I don't think that's how it works. I think it's a classic, if you're using Pachanska's change theory, there has to be some level of consciousness within the organisation.
Yeah.
Of the need for fundamental changes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you end up with a standoff between staff on the shop floor at the coal place who are inspired by a set of values and a toxic, abusing organisation that's not making the staff. An example of a service who we do some work with very indirectly was a service that pushed through lots of changes to staff terms and conditions. It's not a Scottish service, less than we think it is. And on the day that all the staff changes in terms of conditions were pushed through, the chief exec had his new Maserati delivered.
And these changes to staff conditions weren't positive for the staff, I take it?
They were significant cuts in salaries, in sick pay, in overtime rates and things. And I think if the organisation itself does not deliver and lead up to a particular vision, if the organisation doesn't inspire trust.
Yeah.
Yeah, the notion is that childcare workers need to feel nurtured, cherished, valued and supported.
Yeah.
If they are to nurture, cherish, value and support, we need to enable them to contain issues just as ultimately we need to contain.
Yeah.
But if the organisation isn't safe...
Yeah. Sounds toxic.
Yeah, and there are lots of them around.
For sure.
Sandra Bloom's, we talk about failed organisations, which is an interesting expression, rather than kind of corrupted cultures. And what I hadn't necessarily picked up on is her argument is these failed organisations actually can continue working for years. They continue taking kids in and taking staff in. They don't get shut down. They just continue wreaking havoc for decades.
And damaging not just kids, but the staff as well. You know.
Yeah.
I do think change of programme, because that's not maybe the purpose. I think it's staff teams have been stuck, and a lot have maybe been in post for 20, 30 years and have absorbed that training so many times that sometimes the change of programme forces people to look at things in a different way, even if it's a package that's technically the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's
I think they need to revisit theory. I mean, there's the recent supplement to Holding Safely. There's bits of it I like and bits of it I think I'm not quite so sure of. But the recommendation that staff need to revisit theory, I think, is a huge step forward. It's something I've been pushing for decades across lots of contexts, because I've been involved in developing several training systems over the years.
Mm.
And this notion that you have to revisit your physical bit without revisiting the preventive bit always struck me as utterly bizarre. It made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
And
the study I did, that was very much, especially for one particular training package, anybody with that particular training package was only getting the physical for their refresher. Data collection was 2003 to 2005, I think it was, so that's a while back, but it's good to hear that changing. It was deeply concerning. And across the board, it was the majority that were only getting. So that's what they remember, do you know? And yet, the wealth of stuff in there is about de-escalation, understanding what kids need in order to change and to develop in healthy ways and stuff. And
I think there's even somebody recently pointed out to me the kind of traditional ordering effect in terms of training. So we train people. I'm not even sure the word training is appropriate. I think we mentor, educate, nurture, start people on a journey. Then we do the physical stuff, and they kind of walk out of training on the Friday with the physical stuff, kind of preeminent, and think, hey, maybe we should do that the other way around. Maybe we should show the physical stuff and actually spend 2 days showing how not to use it.
Once they're sore.
Maybe look, you really might want to think about how do we avoid this. I'm not sure. The almost every training provider says you have to do the theory before you do the physical interventions. But just somebody pointed out to me, and I was reflecting and thinking, yeah, I don't know, it might be interesting to...
I think that was recent, because I'm on my fourth programme of physical intervention now, and it's mornings are theory, afternoons are physical. And at least in the initial one, which is a full 4 or 5 days, and then you refresh, it's the same. It's half a day theory, half, you know, so 2 days.
I trained in 7 different systems in the late 1990s because I was interested in the differences between them. And I actually was completely and utterly incompetent in all of them because I couldn't remember the terms. Because lots of the terminology, just focusing on the physical stuff, is similar.
That's the problem, it's reducing restraint.
Yeah, exactly. I took so long to, somebody said, do a figure four. Yeah. Okay, I've got 6 different ways of doing that. Which way should I? The kid probably got fed up and moved on. I never recommend that as a method, but it does what
should do that as a strictly comment.
There's one thing I'm interested in training, and one of the differences between training relation and childcare, in training and mental health, good practice guides mental health says you have to involve service users in delivering training. You have to have service users in the room when you're doing the training. And the premise is that that changes the ethos, I suppose, for us.
Because that kind of almost, don't know if I'd like it, but sometimes that black humour that you need to have to just take the stress away, you wouldn't be able to do that.
It's become absolutely ordinary mental health to the extent that people are just, it just happens.
Yeah.
And it evokes similar, but we wouldn't be able to have a frank conversation. Actually, what are we talking about that we're not willing to have with a representative of service users? And if we're,
although being children, and again, at what age, and it probably, in terms of kids being allowed to not have to think about or deal with, you know, although some kids may want to, I think it's really interesting. I've got immediate flood of mixed thoughts about it, but I think it, at least for a portion of the training in terms of kids, and that I think that could be very interesting and empowering actually for kids to be
really useful in time, and if you're refreshing, go the life space interview and what works for them, to hear that.
And even some practicing of the LSI or whatever with kids being the kid, or even kids practicing being staff. I was at East Dumbartonshire, and they had a day for a period of hours over a day that was well planned and thought through, where they did a role reversal. The kids were the staff and the staff were the kids for the day. And we had done that way back when, my first year of practice, and how powerful it was for them, and it was for us too. Ours was impromptu, not well planned, not well thought through. We just kind of had lots of staff on because it was a staff day, staff meeting day. But the kids really got a lot out of it, and I think we did a little bit too. But they're going to do another one in East Dumbartonshire, and it sounds like really innovative practice. Mm-hmm. And then linking that to things like whatever your models are, whether it's life-space intervention or LSI, life-space crisis intervention, or other models that you have for trying to talk things through or dealing with consequences, or we weren't able to record all that very rich conversation we're having about punishment and consequences, but interesting stuff. I think that would be
I think the conversation with punishment does tie into the discussion about restraint, because you're talking about coercion across a continuum, and these kind of strategies we're using to try, at least some staff are using to try and coerce change.
Or even just keep things safe in terms of that notion of consequences and stuff. Yeah, for sure.
But there was something for me about the bit about punishment that kind of seemed like you could do exactly the same thing, and then depending on how you present it, it could just be a practical way of keeping things safe, or it could be presented as a punishment.
Mm.
And I would always go for the practical way of keeping things safe, but I know that for some of our team, there is something about punishment that does contain learning that's not, that may be bypassed if you find a practical way of keeping things safe. But
or a relational way. For me, it was like that was how I was able to shift away from a more punishment oriented thing. It was like, you're still not going out, but it's because I'm worried about you, and I want to speak to you tonight and make sure you're okay or whatever. And that was the example I used before.
Yeah.
But yeah, kids didn't always buy it, and they'd still get pissed off with me or whatever. But I still think there was something fundamentally different about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I might have said it, but there might have been kind of a vengeful thing going on because of the thing I'd gone through with that kid that day. I can't, I'm certainly no saint, but it, at least that was the effort and the direction we were trying to go, as a more relational and practical way rather than a will suffer kind of way.
There's a literature on limit setting which is very interesting, and a really sparse literature in terms of childcare because I was looking at it recently. We were interested in, you know, if you look at the antecedents to violence and aggression, it's often, it's almost invariably some kind of staff interaction is the most immediate antecedent. And if you look at what goes on in that, it often involves staff attempting to set limits, even if the limits are, don't punch me in the head.
Yeah.
And the relatively limited literature on limit setting seems to suggest that with individuals who are impulsive, the only strategy that works is this kind of high affect choice stuff. So, wow, oh, that's really important. We could do this or we could do this. You've got to engage the cortex to get these kids involved. And yet, historically, we just haven't taught people to do that at all.
No. In fact, you're supposed to calm down and get a really flat affect. And
And so it's when you actually look at what the research and limit setting says, it has some really interesting implications if you unpick it and take it back to what staff are trained to do. It's this kind of very calm stuff. Well, actually, there's at least some evidence from some small studies that that's probably wrong.
Yeah.
or at least with some kids, some of the time might be wrong.
How's dyadic exchange stuff? And I'm not an expert on this, but he uses this lovely example, like your friend. And containment theory also has similar things. So your friend's really upset about it, and I can't believe he said that. And actually, what normally happens is, I can't believe it. Really, he said that. And you kind of go up in affect, but you are... as a good friend and as a useful friend, if you stay still contained about it, and then you kind of instinctively, unaware, bring it back down, then that's a useful... But if you get as uncontained with the rage of whatever happened as the friend did, or if you're kind of impassive and flat about the whole thing, neither of those are helpful. And so that makes perfect sense with what you're talking about.
There's a kind of empathic response to empathy. You have to show me.
Yeah,
that
convey.
You recognize some level of my, I need to see it.
Yeah. Is that absorption?
So Gurkhali did the stuff with kids. You know, how do we... Some of the containment stuff for kids, that one of the things we'll do is we will, with very young kids, we'll do a parody of their behaviour if they're agitated. Mm-hmm. But it's so obvious a parody, it's almost a bit kind of cartoonish version of it, which he argued is designed to do two things. One is we have this exaggerated nonverbal stuff, which is giving them a giant set of cues that we're empathising this experience, whereas literally when we just go, a tiny gesture with an adult might convey empathy, but kids need a giant gesture. You know, he was talking about kind of 2-3-year-olds, and then you gradually kind of tone that down because the kid learns to see empathy in tiny gestures.
But a lot of our kids haven't, and so developmentally they might be at a 2 or 3 level related to that part of their perception.
Well, Dan Hughes makes the argument that we need to give kids lots of affect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it ties back into that stuff around limit setting, and it also ties back into that stuff about working with kids maybe who are emotionally much younger.
Yeah.
But then if you come back and say, well, there's lots of practice guides, say stay calm and convey calm, it may not be what these kids particularly need.
Yeah, interesting. You know the advert where it's the stressed out mum and the toddler's crying in the buggy and she just throws everything down in the aisle and starts.
They used to recommend that at the attachment center in Evergreen, Colorado. A colleague of mine ended up working there, so she gave me lots of inside scoop about, and that it was an attachment-based practice, which was somewhat controversial and involved holding therapy. But they would do things like, in the grocery store, if a young person was about to kick off and do a major tantrum and they had a history of it and they'd experienced that with the kid before, the staff would beat them to the punch and throw the tantrum in the grocery store, and the kid would be like, "What are you doing? This is so embarrassing." And they were absolutely, it was stuff that we never would have done, because it was my first place working with her, and then she went on. And like a young man that they worked with, he would soil himself a lot, and that was part of how things were manifesting for him. And so they said, you know, the next time Johnny soils himself, everybody gets ice cream. And he never soiled himself again after that. It was like it totally, this, I guess predictability has its place, but there was a time for something. And so it didn't make people distance themselves from him, and it didn't give him power in a negative way. It became this celebratory thing, and he never did again. So there is all this kind of counterintuitive stuff that it's useful to have space.
The way to have power was not to do it after that.
Yeah, unless you wanted ice cream. Like, that was my question.
I was going to say, that's a bit of a
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he didn't like ice cream or something. I don't know.
I thought you were going to see the staff had to copy him.
In the supermarket.
Yeah.
I had a strange situation a couple of days ago. I was with a young person who'd been getting into a lot of bother while he was out, and we were looking after him in a flat which only had the main door was really the only exit. So we kind of got to the point of thinking he's going to end up getting locked up if we don't do something. So I went along. There was usually only one worker there with him. I went along to join him. The worker who was about to go off, voices were beginning to get raised a bit, and I thought, we're going to be falling out with this person quite soon. And I'd rather it didn't become an argument, because that legitimizes anything more escalated that's going to happen. So I said, I don't want us to get into an argument. We're maybe going to fall out later on. And when that happens, I want you to understand that we're falling out because I'm worried about you and I want to make sure that you're safe. I don't want you to think that we're falling out because we got into an argument. So the other worker left, and I put a chair in front of the front door, and there was tension around while the young person explored out loud whether he would throw me aside and leave, smash the place up or whatever. And everything was okay in the end, but I was quite aware that I was, you know, I hadn't locked the door, but I was preventing him from leaving and giving him a choice between kind of making some physical kind of move towards me or complying with what I was doing. So that seemed fairly coercive, and I feel completely comfortable about it, but I just wonder whether for other people that kind of seems like a more restrictive practice than we should have in a situation where somebody is being looked after without any authorization for them to be locked up or anything like that. My concern was he was going to end up locked up if I didn't do it, because we'd had three situations in the past week out in the street where he'd done things that were either threatening or violent, depending on whether the person got away or not.
I'm not being flippant, but by the chair.
I just felt I was going to be there for a long time.
Yeah.
I was prepared to be there for 8 hours if necessary. And that
so you
was,
were conveying to him
that
you were going to see it through, maybe?
Yeah.
It makes me think about imminent danger, imminent harm, which is like, and often we think about that in a much more short-term sort of way, in terms of restraint, or in this case, it isn't seclusion because you're in the room with him, but in terms of you're still restricting his mobility.
And it wasn't one room. I was at the main door of the building, so the whole building was.
So he could move around the entire building, but he couldn't exit the building.
Yeah.
So, but the imminent harm or imminent danger you're talking about is a slightly more long term.
Yeah.
I think when you say locked up, you don't necessarily mean just for the night. You mean secure or YOI.
We had looked after him in the past and he had been secured and now he'd returned and now we were
so there was a clear
heading
pattern.
Back towards where we had been last time he was secured.
Okay.
But it probably wasn't imminent, you know, in the sense that I wasn't really concerned something terrible is going to happen today if I don't do this. What I was concerned about was if we don't at some point do something differently, then it seems inevitable that we're going to go back through the cycle that we went through last time, and I'm trying to restrict your liberty tonight in order to protect your liberty in the future.
It's tough call. Last tea in the talk, we did talk about restraint related to absconding and how ambiguous it is and how mixed the views are of staff and kids, for that matter, about whether it's acceptable or not. Kids actually, in the study that I did, were less mixed about, especially with property destruction. That was clear cut for them. Restraint should happen in the case of property destruction. And generally speaking, with absconding as well, whereas some staff were like, this is not a secure thing, absolutely not, under no circumstance would I restrain. Whereas other staff were talking about imminent danger, but a much more short-term notion than what you're talking about. Which, and that's even complex in the short term, and how you would establish that. Imminent danger always is a bit of crystal ball gazing, you know, unless the danger or the harm is already happening and you're stopping it from happening. Mm. But what you're talking about is much more long-term, and I think is an important thing to consider in terms of the number of kids who hears the door, and end up being secured.
I mean, there was something for me, I suppose, that I might have made a completely different decision with another young person. I felt confident that while that person might try and physically remove me from out of his way, our relationship meant that he wouldn't try and seriously hurt me in order to do that. So the worst thing that was likely to happen was I would be unsuccessful in preventing him from leaving.
And if it was a young person who had that similar pattern that you're describing, and you felt like you were trying to interrupt the pattern because it was heading that way again, but you didn't have the kind of relationship where you assessed that, what would have been different for you, do you think?
Well, then to me, I suppose the risk of him committing a serious offence in the building would probably have been higher than the risk of him doing it outside of the building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that didn't feel as though that was likely to happen in this situation. So to me, it felt like the risk of something going seriously wrong was higher outside than inside, even with me at the door.
So it wasn't just your physical presence sitting on that chair in front of the door that barred him, it was the relationship that held him in the flat. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. I think if I hadn't been sitting there, he would definitely have left. I think the relationship made him reluctant to put hands on me.
Yeah.
And he had to choose to do that if he wanted to leave.
Okay.
And that, I mean, it struck me that you were making a judgment about his ability to make choices. Because in one sense, when you initially described it, I had a degree of anxiety because sometimes kids who tip over into full-blown fight-flight, blocking the flight is a really bad idea.
Yeah,
indeed, actually, a kid running away rather than hitting somebody actually can be a significant step forward.
Yes.
But my sense was your kind of professional judgment was this kid had sufficient emotional regulation that he wasn't going to fully tip over into that fight-flight.
Yeah, I still think he might have, with somebody else, not with everybody else, but with some other people, I think that could have happened if the relationship wasn't enough to kind of hold him in a place where he felt, you know, that he could be angry and feel something positive towards me at the same time.
I'm just wondering as well, it's a little bit about the history of your relationship with that young person.
Yeah. And maybe that call at that moment about, like, well, I'm not going to get in a fight with you because mm-hmm. we've not had a history of rolling about on the floor. You've never taken me in a fight, so to speak. Therefore, by you sitting here, you know that it's not a challenge to a fight. You know that yeah. by sitting there, you're not going to put yourself in danger.
It's the second advantage of sitting.
Why would a national adult put themselves in yeah. obvious danger?
Yeah.
So he knows that you are giving him a choice, uh-huh. but he also knows that you know what the decision that choice would make at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know fully what... all I felt confident about was he didn't want to hurt me. I didn't know whether he would try and, you know, move me out of the way and leave, or whether he would
in a non-assumptive way. Mm. Is that
yeah,
what you mean?
Yeah, that was the bit I felt yeah. confident about.
You know, the other thing that it raises for me, and it relates to what you were talking about, Brody, in terms of all the different levels of organizational and cultural and societal, has to do with, and it's moving a bit, but in terms of professional qualification and expectation that's necessary for that kind of work, the kind of fine-tuned professional judgment that you exercised and the discretion that you exercised in that moment comes from a lot of your life experience and your natural qualities and abilities, but it also comes from some formal learning. And for most of us in the field, there's a mixture, and some of us need more form, whatever, but in terms of violence reduction and reducing restraint in a way that still meets the needs of kids, I think this whole area of how well we equip and whether the courses are the right courses for staff as well is really central to this. And so again, it's not just about what happens between that member of staff and that kid or even the organization, it's the wider, you know, I mean, for you to say all that shows a huge level of reflection, self-awareness, awareness of different aspects of practice. And
I think we need to shift out as well that sometimes in terms of arousal levels, staff and kids, for us to see a crisis, we sometimes need to feel that there's that immediate threat instead of actually he's in crisis and it's over days, it's over weeks, and recognising there at that point in time it was about the behaviours leading up and potentially afterwards. You know, if you think how often a young person gets restrained in the morning and behaviours later on in the day or the next day, you don't see that it's actually all related, and we end up then feeling anxious because we've backed off or we haven't done that because, well, that was yesterday, that can't still be going on. And,
yeah.
You know, we've got our lovely social workers that do crisis intervention, and well, that's a period of 6 to 8 weeks that we intervene. And we beat ourselves up because we sit there for 8 hours.
Yeah, and most of the time I would probably have decided to do something different from that. Most of the time I would normally think there's not an imminent risk of something serious happening at the moment if he leaves. Therefore, I should try and persuade him not to, but not get physically involved if he chooses to do that.
But there's a prediction there that because of what's happened the days before, that's the likelihood he's still in that place.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think there's a way of thinking about de-escalation, which I think is quite helpful, in that every time we're trying to de-escalate an instance, in essence, we're doing an experiment. And that's like you kind of did an experiment, not reducing what was going on to kind of subject to experiment, but you didn't really know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't always necessarily know what a child will respond to or won't.
Yeah.
You know, we have some sense of the child, where the child is, perhaps a history and tense structure responded before, the nature of our relationship, what might work for us another. But sometimes it depends on whether the child allows us to use these strategies. You know, what's the kind of classic one? Humour. But humour isn't something you do to a child. It's something that's done in conjunction with a child.
Yeah.
It's the notion of the kind of co-creationist bit. You know, the strategies are used in conjunction with individuals, even in crisis. And sometimes kids will allow you to do that, and sometimes they won't.
And how maddening it was, especially my first year or two of practice, of like, well, it worked with them before. Why is it working? If we could just figure it out, you know? Yeah. And then I started to blame the kids for, like, they change it. Every time you figure it out, they go and change, and they won't let it work anymore. Yeah. I'm curious if with him, you made a decision about physically preventing him from going, but you felt that he wouldn't assault you and it wouldn't go to that. If you felt it would go to restraint, to keep him there at that point, and you had to keep it hypothetically, you had adequate staff to make to do carry it out safely, would you have allowed it to go to that level in the way that you barred him without him assaulting you or whatever? Because I mean, it sounds like you didn't want him to experience having that assault and then having the charge, but would you have restrained him if it had to go that way and it was safe to do so, as safe as it can be?
It probably would come down to practical factors for me. If I felt as though we could do it successfully, I would probably have found that worthwhile. Practical things do really affect that. In where I usually work, there are so many exits, you know, fire exits that just push open ground floor windows, that we usually end up not doing that. And it's not that we don't want to do it, it's just that we know that we could spend 3 hours doing that and then somebody would leave after all of that. So it feels like we would have all of the disadvantages of, you know, both having all of that kind of that risky and stressful stuff going on, and then the outcome being exactly the same as it had been if we hadn't done it. So if I felt confident that we could do it and that would be successful, I would have wanted to do it. But I suppose what I really believed was that I was reducing the possibility of there being a physical restraint by doing what I was doing, because if I hadn't done that, but I'd want to leave, I would need to be the one to decide to put hands on him.
Yeah.
What I was trying to set up was that he would need to make a decision of whether to put hands on me or not.
That's interesting. And this was a few days ago?
That was last Thursday, so nearly a week.
Has he absconded or gotten into that kind of, just out of curiosity, experimental results?
I mean, that was the other issue, that I knew that we couldn't keep that going, that it was, the show was only on for one night, really, and the normal service might be resumed the next day. But so far, it seems as though there has been a change in what has been happening. Although he has been able to go out on the kind of subsequent days, that having had 3 incidents within a week of threatening or trying to attack other people, there hasn't been anything in the intervening period.
And what would you account for, touchwood, early days, possibly a shift for him?
There are a few things going on simultaneously, because something has shifted at home as well, and he's had contact with his mum for the last 4 days in a row. So I think it feels as though simultaneously he felt a bit more settled with us, but also a bit less isolated from his family as well. So it's quite difficult to work out what would have happened if those two things hadn't happened.
Do you have a sense about that 8-hour period having anything to do with it or not?
I think there is, for me, there is something significant that before that, because as I was saying earlier, we have usually chosen not to do that. So that night was preceded by several months of him walking out the door and us not preventing him from doing that, because we felt, while he was in the main residential place with all the exits, that we couldn't really prevent that. We're working with him in a kind of flat at the moment, which provides that possibility, but that was the first night we'd actually used it. So there might be something slightly more in his mind about feeling as though we are slightly more able to keep him safe now than he felt about us, you know, a week ago.
That was a feeling I think I had when you were talking about this. There was this notion that you were, the conversation before you put your chair in front of the door was about, I am a safe adult, this is not about what we want to do, but I'm also going to be the authoritative adult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was willing to accept you in that role.
Yeah.
So you got lots of shouting and screaming and banging, but he didn't really lose his temper, because losing his temper would have been hitting him.
Yeah.
What he did actually was display acceptable annoyance.
But I feel as though we came very close to doing something very different from that. That there was the beginnings of voices being raised and an argument going on, and I had a feeling that maybe everybody else would have felt more comfortable to go down that road and have some kind of argument and a physical restraint and have that all there, rather than have the hours of tension of kind of thinking, will he, won't he? You know?
Well, so it's strange that it's been a means of reducing stress.
For sure. And I'm wondering about this. This is the next paper, once the PhD is done, is about catharsis and about not only kids potentially consciously or unconsciously using restraint as a way to have strong, big expressions of emotion, and the number of kids who cry through restraint or release a lot of rage. But I wonder about how many staff unwittingly take it to restraint to experience that vicarious catharsis, especially with that buildup of tension of, will it go to restraint, won't it, will he attack me, won't he, and let's just... I mean, you hear staff sometimes talk about just getting it over with, if it's going to happen anyway, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I wonder about, there's a cathartic thing that happens. I don't think it's just for kids.
Yeah.
I think there's a vicarious kind of purging that sometimes staff may be experiencing, that if we create spaces for that strong expression of emotion without it having to go to restraint, maybe another way of reducing. And for staff as well, to have places to have that strong expression and purging of all of that buildup of stuff that we absorb through the day.
So. The tents for the autistic kids,
getting
for staff.
Yeah.
Giant bulb.
I'm going in the bulb for 5 minutes.
Yeah, definitely. We used to have big, huge, like Uzi water guns, and once the kids were all in bed, it was this big building. We would go on a different floor so we wouldn't disturb the kids, and there would be these huge running around squirting each other with water guns as a way of, I think, diffusing some of the tension of the day. And, you know,
there has that catharsis stuff, though, is interesting. You know, there has been this kind of focus in the past. There were a couple of American studies that compared units that taught kids, you know, did kind of American football and lots of physical stuff, and tended to find units that kind of expressed that kind of physical catharsis actually has higher levels of restraint.
Yeah.
I think it's different ways of expressing, you know, maybe deep tissue massage or Tai Chi or something. I'm not sure that physically expressing it is always, or at least it depends on the context in which you physically express it.
Chef, who's done a lot of research on catharsis, talks about, his definition is it's an involuntary physical reaction. And so instead of having a kid punch a punching bag while they say how much they hate their abusive father or whatever, it's more about creating, and laughter actually is a form of catharsis to either embarrassment or boredom, I think is what he said. But so we have these different physical catharsis is related, and I think a lot of kids are looking to cathart, again, unconsciously, and I don't even think it's a verb, cathart, but to purge some of that grief, but they're doing it through angry cathartic, and again, so that fits with the research evidence as well, versus how vulnerable it is to cry, and yet it's the physical act of crying that allows for the physical release of grief. And all of our kids have experienced separation and loss just by being with us, let alone all the other layers of that. And so how safe is it for kids to be able to cry? How safe is it for staff to be able to cry about all of that pain that's floating about? And so I wonder about kids that I worked with that got stuck in this cycle of restraint, trying to, I think, possibly bleed off some of that grief, but through an anger kind of catharsis, and so it was never satisfying that need. I don't know, I mean, it's purely exploratory at this point, although there were kids who talked about restraint in terms that definitely can be seen as looking for a physical and emotional catharsis. And staff talked about witnessing it as well. So,
I think the whole loss issue is really significant. You know, how do we enable kids to actually come to terms with huge losses,
mm-hmm.
including sometimes losses of childhood in any meaningful sense?
Yeah.
You know, so losses of relationship, losses of safety. They've often physically lost, you know, relatives through all the early death stuff.
Yeah.
And enabling staff to be comfortable in talking about losses with all the resonance that has in terms of their own losses, I think is one of the areas which isn't as well addressed as it really could be.
And staff loss as well. All the kids that you put so much into trying to, and then, you know, you lose that kid through them, you know, losing the placement, or worse losses yet, some of which have been in the news very recently, and yet nobody ever talked to me when I was in practice about, you know, not only that absorbed mm-hmm. loss from kids, but our own losses when we invest so much in kids and then we see them end up insecure or worse. So
I had a long time ago, some service manager had a staff team. We had a service user with young man, mental health issues, bipolar disorder, trauma issues, very complex presentation and very dangerous, kind of rapidly cycling bipolar, so he wasn't safe even kind of 2-to-1 ratio. He'd come to us from high school and we put huge amounts of work into him and we just couldn't make it work. And the consensus, everybody said he has to go back to high school, and we did it. And the staff were incredibly angry at me and the manager. And I'm thinking, I did what you wanted me to do, why are you? And it took my supervisor to say, they're not angry at you for doing that. They have to be angry at somebody because they failed and they've lost and they were really attached to this guy.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of mourned him in terms of moving on. Yeah. They didn't want him to go. At the very least, these strong feelings of ambivalence, but kind of,
yeah.
I was quite upset. I felt I was being victimized. Until I kind of thought, we do know where this is coming from.
Yeah. I mean, it's even a loss when they go under good circumstances, but it's much worse when it's. Yeah.